You guys know I'm crazy about Audible because it offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Audible really is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment, with female writers and heroines, celebrity narration, multicast productions with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks. Audible has you covered for any type of excitement that you're looking for. In fact, right now I'm listening to The Second Husband by Kate White. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. That's audible.com/realitylife or text realitylife to 500-500. With four daughters and two on a dance team, I can tell you we go through a lot of mascara in my house. But I'm crazy about L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara, which catches every lash from corner to corner for maximum volume. If you're looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank, this is yours. The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. I've been using it for about 2 weeks now, and I feel like my eye has completely opened up, and the girls are crazy about it too. They've got a tapered brush to catch every lash, one of the best mascara wands that I've ever used. And like I said, this luxe appearance of this gold package, you got to get it. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today. L'Oreal Paris new Panorama Mascara. You're going to love it.
The amazing Kate Casey.
Welcome back to another episode of Reality Life with Kate Casey. Hope that you had a great weekend. I spent most of my weekend on sports fields, baseball field and soccer field. And I'm going to be honest with you, and I hate to say this, but I think that my daughter's soccer team right now is a little bit of the bad news bears of soccer. Let me tell you something. I had a moment where I thought, I'm no longer judging people in other countries that doctor birth certificates, because I was trying to recruit players from the sidelines from a lawn chair. I'm not saying I'm there yet. I'm saying I could be there. And I'm just saluting all the parents that spend their weekends on sports fields. And speaking of sports, this episode I was so excited about because I got a chance to talk to a former pro tennis player. What you guys need to know is that my husband has the tennis channel on at our house all the time. I mean, he goes to all the tournaments. He plays in tournaments. I have to remind him he's not in the running to play at Wimbledon, like obsessed with tennis. So when the creators of Wild Wild Country, which is, of course, one of my obsessions, started to do these episodes, this five-part docuseries on Netflix called Untold. As you know, I've been crazy about it because there are these untold stories in sports. So they let me know the last episode is about tennis. And it was one of the only times in my entire marriage where my husband watched something with me, because this episode is all about Marty Fish opening up about his struggles with mental health. So the story of Marty Fish's foray into tennis chronicles his training at the famed Saddlebrook Academy as a teen, his brotherhood and constant competition with comrade Andy Roddick. He actually lived in Andy Roddick's house with his parents, and his inability to find major success like his predecessors. So the American tennis icons of the 80s and the 90s, John McEnroe, Pete Sampras, Andre Agassi. So in 2010, he got himself into the best shape of his life and emerged on the ATP Tour as a force to be reckoned with, scaling the heights of the World Tour Finals in 2011 as the top-seeded American player. But soon after, his anxiety began to swell and he began to push through mental strain at the 2012 U.S. Open quarterfinals against Roger Federer, who, by the way, is my husband's Lord and Savior. But an encroaching sense of dread and anguish was worsening by the day, and everything came to a crashing halt. With the help of his wife, Stacy, he bowed out of the match and was later diagnosed with severe anxiety disorder. So as the number one ranked American male tennis player, he shockingly quit tennis and over the course of the next few years, largely disappeared from the public, staying in his house for months at a time. So after seeking professional help, he worked through his trauma and went public with his struggles to help destigmatize anxiety and provide other athletes a model to follow when dealing with their own mental health issues. So he has since become the U.S. Davis Cup coach and describes his anxiety as a daily battle, but I win every day. And there's perhaps no better time to explore this as Naomi Osaka, who's Marty's friend, announced tearfully at her third round defeat at the US Open that she planned to take an indefinite break from the game that no longer brings her joy even when she wins. So it's an interesting shift that we're seeing in sports to hear so many more athletes talk about mental health. Tennis, as you may know, is an unusual sport because the ATP rulebook states that players cannot receive coaching during a tournament match. So that's communications of any kind. So that's audible or visible between a player and a coach because it could be construed as coaching. So imagine playing in a two-hour match, hundreds of thousands of people watching you. That's just in person, let alone the television. A multi-million dollar check waiting in the wings, and you're about to play the greatest player in the world, and you feel like your heart's about to stop because an anxiety attack is coming on. So I was thrilled to talk to Marty Fish. And then I've been really excited to watch the new season of Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. I've been very open. I didn't love the first season. I was worried how they would all feel connected because it didn't feel like they felt connected in the first season. And I'm happy to tell you, it's a much better season. This season's got a lot going on. First of all, Mary's life has changed drastically. She's been forced to close the doors to her church, which is kind of like a skeptical church, if you know what I'm saying. Her husband's nowhere to be found, and she started a faith-based podcast to fill the void. And then there are rumors about Mary becoming a topic of conversation after Lisa's friend reveals from some unsettling allegations. So that's pretty juicy. Heather's business, Beauty Lab and Laser, is thriving. It's on the precipice of growing into its second location, but then she's got a daughter going off to college. After reconciling last year, Meredith and her husband are going strong, but there still appears to be a few cracks in their foundation, so they're working through that. And she's got a fragile relationship with her best friend, Lisa, who she really questions her loyalty. Whitney's struggling to balance it as her budding business really kind of starts to pull her away from her stay-at-home duties. Jen is focusing on her inner zen, and 2 months into filming, charges come down, and there's a helicopter flying above a tour bus where they're about to take a trip, and a SWAT team arrives at Heather's place of business looking for Jen. So that, of course, leaves a whole other layer to the show. And then we've got a new housewife who's married with 3 kids, just sold her business, and was a child refugee from Vietnam. So there are a lot of layers, a lot of really interesting personalities. And this is like the Salt Lake version of Beverly Hills because we've got charges filed against a housewife. So there's plenty to unpack. And I asked legal commentator and my friend Emily D. Baker to come on and to unravel it with me. So it's a jam-packed episode. So here we go. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way that you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, and they pass the savings on to us. So I just got a 100% organic cotton tiered maxi skirt in red and a chiffon pleated midi skirt in soft pink. Now I'm going to wear both of them with either a white scoop t-shirt or a black tank top. In fact, wait, should we all get the same outfit and meet for drinks? Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/KKC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/KKC to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/KKC. This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. If you're looking for new style inspiration, Saks.com is the place to go. Saks.com is making it easy for me to shop for the spring with their selection of chic clothes and accessories. Right now, I'm looking at Saks.com so I can find my new going out vibe. I'm looking for a breezy Zimmermann dress for an evening cocktail party. And for my upcoming conference in Los Angeles, I'm looking at bright Chloe blazers because I'm pushing myself to wear more orange and pink. Saks.com will inspire you to shop for everything on your agenda. So find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com. Anxiety forced Marty Fish to withdraw from the 2012 U.S. Open, and now he's open about his mental health and works with the USTA to provide more resources for players. His episode of Untold is my most favorite of all of the episodes. You guys know I'm obsessed with the series. It is so well done, and Marty's story was my absolute favorite. I am thrilled to tell you I have tracked him down today. Marty, welcome to the show.
What an endorsement. Thank you for having me. That's awesome.
Best episode. My husband and I are crazy tennis fans, and I love the episode because it was more of your personal story. And you had an incredible career. I love the story about your friendship with Andy Roddick. You were long considered one of the most talented players of your era. You improved your fitness and really got yourself so far up in the rankings. And then this anxiety issue started to creep in. I know that you began experiencing a racing heartbeat that would wake you up in the middle of the night, and that you were diagnosed with a form of arrhythmia. How else did you know something had been changing in you?
Yeah, thank you for the intro. I didn't know anything about mental health prior to 2012, sort of July. No one around me had suffered from any mental health issues. I didn't, and was sort of super naive about what it was. I had a heart issue called tachycardia, which is like an electrical issue around your heart. Very common. I had a procedure called an ablation, which they go through the main vein into your heart, and they recreate the issue that's going on, which is the electricity can malfunction. There's electricity around your heart. It's like the quarterback to your heart. So when it fires, it tells your heart to beat. So fire, ba bum, fire, ba bum. Some of them can malfunction. There's thousands of electrodes in there. They can malfunction. And when they do, it your heart doesn't know anything else but to beat. So the ba 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 when they fire. And it was a really uncomfortable situation. It's not like your heart's beating at 150 beats per minute, like you ran a sprint. I'm talking like 230 beats per minute, you know, like where you can't recreate your heart beating this fast without something like this happening. So it was a really scary, traumatic sort of experience to have that happen a few times. I had to go to the hospital once for it because I thought I was legitimately thought I was dying. I could not stop my heart. I was a very diligent worker in terms of my fitness. Since I, you know, had lost the weight, went on the diet and changed my lifestyle and ultimately my life. And so I trained with a heart rate monitor on because I wanted to know how high I could get my heart rate. And then how in 25 seconds, which is how much time we have in between points, how quickly I could get it down and how far I could get it down with my breathing. So like I was really diligent with how I worked on and off the court when I was training. I could never get my heart to beat faster than 192 beats per minute. Never saw it. I physically could not do it. I tried as hard as I could. I ran so many sprints and did so many drills on the court to try and do it. 192 was as high as I saw. So when your heart's beating that fast, I could get my heart to fall down very quickly in those sort of 25, 30 seconds that we would give myself. And I could get it back down to like 120 or 115 real quickly. In these scenarios, when it was happening, I couldn't get it to move anywhere. So it was really, really scary. From that, you know, kind of from those traumatic kind of experiences that I had, we fixed the ablation, you know, the ablation fixed the tachycardia and the heart issue. So that was never an issue. I never really felt like, oh, my heart's, you know, not going to, they're going to blow up. I didn't know what was my heart going to blow up? You know, I had, you know, so naive, I had no idea. And so moving along to, I pulled out of the French Open, moving along to Wimbledon that year. I was still in sort of the top 10, 12 in the world, you know, kind of thing, still at a high, you know, in the prime of my career. And I remember at Wimbledon sort of starting to have these thoughts of that were just different. They were just like, am I going to be okay today? Why, you know, did I eat too much food? Am I going to feel bloated? And in turn, is that going to make me feel uncomfortable? Because when I do, I just don't feel that well. You know, I just, if I didn't get enough sleep the night before, am I going to feel okay? You know, it was just like, if anything was off, I had a headache, or like if anything was off, it would just sort of trigger these little thoughts where I was just like, what's wrong with me? Is something wrong with me? I remember asking my father at the time, like, is something, did you, you know, cause he had to put a pacemaker in, he had a heart issue as well. And is totally fine now. And I asked him, I said, do you ever have those thoughts, you know, after the fact? No, it felt okay. You know, whatever. So I just sort of pushed it aside and just sort of kept playing and playing that summer. And 2012, the US Open came around, and, I had just gotten to a point where every place that I went, every thought that I had outside of the tennis court put me in this anxiety situation. You know, like I was having an anxiety attack like every 15 minutes. It wouldn't come like every other hour or something like that. I wished I would do anything to sort of, by this time, this is 2 months down the road probably. And I had sort of understood, okay, this is probably what's going on here. This anxiety disorder, panic disorder. Thankfully I didn't have any depression issues or anything like that, but that can be super scary as well. And so I went to, went on the tennis court. That was the only place that would give me any place of soul, you know, comfort. I had other things to worry about on the tennis court. You know, I had to try and beat the other guy across the net. I had to try and work on my game on the practice court. For whatever reason, that was my only safe haven. That part was taken away in the third round of that tournament, US Open. And I had an anxiety attack, panic attack on the court in the fourth set of a match. It was a night match at Arthur Ashe Stadium. So you can imagine there's lots of people there. You know, there's television cameras everywhere. So certainly there's lots of people watching on TV. And I didn't know what to do. And as tennis players, and I mean, I think a lot of tennis players are like this, where we vividly remember matches, you know, most of our matches, you know, we vividly remember games and points and during, oh man, I could have done this or that in that match. And I remember that shot and that, you know, I don't remember anything from 3-2 in the fourth set, nothing. The only thing I can remember was my friend, Justin Gimelstob, who was doing the Tennis Channel commentary that night and doing the interview after on the court. And I just remember saying to him, please hurry, please hurry. And he's like, okay, you know, it's like, it was late, you know, it was probably 1:30 in the morning. We got done late, matches before us went long too. So it was a late night period for everyone. And so that's probably what he was thinking, but I was thinking something totally different. I was having a full blown anxiety attack. And the only way that I felt comfortable or was going to feel comfortable was if I ran off and went into the medical sort of area in the locker room, got the doctors to hook me up to an EKG unit, because I knew that it was all going to check out fine. But if they put me with these cords on me, I just felt more comfortable. And so just please just hook me up. I know it's going to say everything's fine. My EKG is going to look totally fine, but just please hook me up to this thing. And they did. And you know, an hour passed and I was able to unhook them and get off and go back to the hotel and sort of start the process of, I guess, getting ready for the next match. You're just going through, racing through, how am I going to do this? How am I going to play? How am I going to beat Roger Federer, first of all? And then how am I going to not embarrass myself? How am I going to gather in front of all these people? And thank God my wife was with me, and we are trained from a young age to never show weakness, never show fear, never show being tired across the net or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I didn't do it great when I played, but we're trained like that always to never really show that. I was always very vulnerable to my wife or to my parents or my, you know, very, very, very close friends, but never, you know, super outwardly vulnerable to anyone else. And so I didn't know how I was going to handle this match. I don't know how I was going to play it. And again, not having the mindset of just like no weakness, no fear, all, you know, at all times. And she said to me as I'm crying in the car, how am I going to do this? How am I going to do this? You don't have to play. And like this like wave just washed over me and I went, oh, you're right. I don't have to play. And it never, ever would have crossed my mind if she wasn't there. If someone who didn't have that upbringing of, you know, not training like that at, from a young age, you know, and maybe a little bit, and I say this sometimes, maybe it was a little bit of like a female's touch, you know, like of like having some comfort, you know, had just some understanding, and you guys have more understanding than we do, I think. And more compassion of like the situation and understanding that and just going, you don't have to play. And it never would have crossed my mind. And it did. And so she said it, and right then and there, I felt better. And that was sort of the rock bottom of my mental health issues to where I needed to, you know, eventually find help and, you know, get a good support system around me and everything to try and beat it.
So you were homebound for a little while, and then you finally got therapy and medication. You're very outspoken now about mental health struggle and the mental health struggle of an athlete. And I'm sure that you feel very connected to Naomi Osaka. And I think your voice is so important right now because there is a huge population of men that are, I think, very hard on Naomi Osaka. And the way that you've just said to the New York Times, she's not playing because she doesn't want to talk to the press. I mean, that just one sentence really encapsulates how simple it is. But yet people have a really hard time having empathy, having understanding. So I want to first say thank you for your voice. I think it's really important. And I want to know what you want other people to know about what they can do when they're in their own mental health struggle.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. Education is first and foremost, like, you know, coming out. There were a few things that I thought about as I came out with my sort of story, I guess, in 2015. I wrote a piece with the Players Tribune, and that's where I sort of first came out with my struggles and where I had been for the last, you know, sort of 2 years, and just kind of disappeared off the tennis map. Educating others on mental health, just, you know, the signs that you know, what you feel like, what it can feel like, how you can't see it. It's an injury, a physical injury, in my opinion, but you can't, you don't see it like an ankle or a, you know, a wrist injury, and you've got it wrapped up and you actually see that as somebody walks by limping or something. Oh, that person's injured. In mental health, it's inside, it's internal, and you can't see it. So you have to have understanding, non-judgment, compassion about that first and foremost. And then understanding how to not only beat it, but understand that you're not alone, you know, like that tens of millions of just Americans deal with this on a daily basis. I can't tell you how many Twitter messages I've gotten, direct messages on my account. Hundreds of people have written, and it came out yesterday. So hundreds of people have written, whether it's a direct message or a text message, just saying, thank you for coming out with this. I've been struggling with something like this as well. This is, one lady wrote something that said she had been struggling with anxiety because her boss wanted her to get up in front of a bunch of people and talk. After watching your documentary, I called my boss right away and I said, I'm ready to do it tomorrow. Like those types of things are really amazing to get those types of stories, because I'm not doing it for me. I feel good. I'm doing it for others who may not have a success story to lean on and say, oh, no one around me and my family has necessarily had a struggle with mental health, but I'm dealing with it. And there's an athlete that I may or may not have heard of or whatever that, that had it and struggled with it pretty badly and got out of it and got out of the fire, got back and played still at a high level, and beat it every day. My psychiatrist said something, a couple months in that really sort of resonated still. And I said to him one day as we were just talking and just having another session, and I said, I just can't wait for this to be over. Like, just be behind me and put, you know, like I can get back my life back and back to playing golf and having a beer with my friends and going out to dinner or going out to a bar or something like that. Which at the time, you know, 6 months in, I was unfathomable to think of being able to do. And he looks at me and he says, "Marty, this will always be part of your life. This will never be something you just forget about." And like right away, I was like, "I think you're wrong." And it's so true, because every day that goes by, I have stresses. I've moved from, you know, the tennis world a little bit. I'm still in the tennis world, but to the finance world. And so I have other stresses and anxieties in my life, my, you know, everyday life that don't have anything to do with being a professional tennis player. I still get anxiety over that stuff. But I have tools and ways to beat it right away. Learning from those episodes, those bad episodes, and how to deal with that, how to change the channel, change the negative thoughts in your head. I always call it changing the channel on your negative thoughts. Like, how do I change the channel very quickly on this thought and go to a good thought? And there are just, you know, it's so important to have a great support system and then ways to get you out of that mindset. And so I'm just trying to tell people how I beat it. And give someone hope that, like, as bad as it can be, you can beat it, and you can get your life back. You can be totally fine. You can get up in front of people. You can get back into the U.S. Open and play a big match in front of millions of people or thousands of people in the stadium, and I don't know how many are watching. I did it, and if I can do it, you can do it.
So you're working as a mentor during the U.S. Open as part of a new initiative from the USTA to provide more mental health resources for players. Can you tell everybody where they can find you?
So you can find me on, I'm on Twitter, at Marty Fish. I get a lot of comments on there. So feel free to write anything you want. I don't have Instagram, and I've got a foundation. I've got a foundation, a charity that's called the Marty Fish Children's Foundation. And we work with after school. We have after school programs for underprivileged kids. We've been doing it this is our 13th year. We've helped over 2,400 kids every year, provide them a safe place to play sports, to do their homework, to eat healthy, things like that. And that's in Indian River County, which is where I grew up in Vero Beach, Florida. So I did that with my best friend, Jake Owen, who has his foundation as well. We used to do a Jake and Marty Fest. And now, since his country career is going through the roof, it's harder to sort of get us on the same date, but we sort of partner with that as well. So Twitter, I guess, if anyone's interested in the charitable stuff, that's where we are.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Kate.
Whether you need to buy or sell, or you're just obsessed with looking at homes for sale, Redfin's got you covered. Redfin updates their listings every 2 minutes so you can see new homes first. And they give you personalized recommendations based on the homes that you like, so you can find the home that's just right for you, whether that's a cabin, a craftsman, or a castle. With the top-rated Redfin app, you can favorite homes, share listings with others, and schedule tours, and even on the same day, with a local Redfin agent who can help guide you through the whole home buying process. And if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents have the experience to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they sell twice as many homes as other agents. With a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards what matters most to you, like your next home. In fact, last year, Redfin saved home sellers $127 million. No matter where you are in your real estate journey, Redfin can help. Download the Redfin app to get started today.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Emily D. Baker's back. I had to ask her about the season premiere of The Real Housewives of Salt Lake City. Emily, welcome back.
Yes, I'm so excited to be back. I've been waiting for this. Like, have you been waiting for this? I've been waiting for this premiere. I'm excited. I'm embarrassed to say how excited I was, but that first 2 minutes, man, I was living for it. And now they're going to drag it out the rest of the entire season.
Well, the first question out of the gate is, what are the charges against Jen Shah? So dumb it down for us. What do we
Absolutely.
Need to know? Especially as we go into this episode, and we need to know as we see her closet filled with boots and outfits and her lackadaisical attitude about being under investigation. What was she up against here?
So just by way of a summary, and I do have content like breaking down all of this. The government has given us so much information in this case. It is a lot. But on kind of a surface level, the first count against her is conspiracy to commit wire fraud. We've talked about wire fraud in other cases, you and I together, with relation to Elizabeth Holmes. The conspiracy to commit wire fraud is the agreement to defraud people using the wires. And that can be advertisements, emails, transferring the money. So there are a lot of things that can constitute wire fraud. So that's her first count with her and Stuart Smith. Count two is obstruction of justice, which, you know, is fantastic. Wait, that one got dropped as to her. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the other indictment. Count two is the conspiracy to commit money laundering. As I was looking at her co-defendant's indictment, she just has the money laundering and the conspiracy to commit wire fraud. The money laundering being the transferring it around to different bank accounts, offshore accounts, and things like that. So those are the two big counts that she is up against.
So if we were to be talking to the government right now and they were to lay out for us a typical victim under this umbrella, who has been victimized under the business operations that she's been running, according to the government?
Yeah, it's very interesting because in the indictment, they really do lay out an overview of the scheme, and then they make these special allegations that can be sentencing enhancements later. So the amount of time you get on the charge is what you get under the guidelines. But then because they're alleging that there are a substantial amount of victims over the age of 55 that are particularly vulnerable, then you can add time as an enhancement to the judge down the road. So they are alleging that a lot of these victims were over the age of 55 and not super computer savvy. And the scheme was to bring in these leads. And when you brought in these leads, to sell them to different sales floors and then recoup monies from selling these leads. The way that they did it was not on the up and up. They had previously been investigated by the FTC for this back in 2017. And she had gone to depositions and stuff back then with regard to these companies. And the thing that changed is she got more sneaky about the way she was doing it, according to the documents the government has filed in court. So in all of this, it was people who weren't particularly savvy on the internet telling them that they were going to make, or allegedly telling them that they were going to make a lot of money and they were going to have these businesses online and websites just make money. And people lost a lot of money. If you go and look at some of the Better Business Bureau reviews for some of these businesses, people lost everything. And some of these schemes that she's connected to but not directly charged with, they had a second part. When people got in debt trying to keep up with this business, they would then refinance the debt and take more money from people. So this is a very large scheme. There were two previous trials with different groups of defendants before we got to this third round of indictments that alleges activity from 2020 all the way through to 2021. And there were already 11 defendants in this thing by the time she got pulled in.
So somebody answers the phone. Maybe they're over, you know, 55 or in that age range. They pick up the phone, and who's on the other end, and what are they basically saying to convince them?
based on the documents that we've seen, they are saying, you know, hey, now's a great time to make money on the internet. You can have a website. We get it all ready for you. It's plug and play. How they came across the leads is still not exactly clear from all of the documents that I've read where they were getting people from, but it looked like they were targeting websites to collect information that people maybe didn't know was going to be sold. So if you were Googling around the internet looking for like make money from home or you know, e-commerce or selling on eBay, then your information would kind of be swooped in. And we've heard her reference this, that she's building an algorithm to grab people. Well, that's not exactly right. How the government says that it went down. The government says that these websites weren't following the procedures they were supposed to follow, and they were taking people's information, and then those people were being hard sold an opportunity. And then they were being sold coaching with the opportunity, and then a full website package with the opportunity, and then tax help, and then. And the allegations are that they didn't make money and that these businesses never got up and running.
Do we know anything about when this business began, how she got into it? And that leads into questions about how much her husband knew. But what was the genesis of this company?
I am not clear from everything I've read what the origin is, because this is rolled through multiple different companies with different company names. So it is not just one company from 2012 to 2021, because in the 2017 depositions with regard to the investigation by the FTC back then, it was companies under different names. And even in this, there are companies under different names. So it looks like as a company became problematic, it had too many chargebacks, the company would get shut down and pay processors wouldn't work with them. So when a company hits a threshold, and this is all in the government documents that they filed, mostly in response to her filings in court, when payment processors like a Stripe or a Square or American Express or Visa would see too high a percentage of chargebacks, they would not allow the company to keep processing credit. So then it seems that this scheme would shut down that company name and then just start another one doing the same thing with a different name so that they could continue processing payments. And that seemed to roll company to company to company, which is where you're seeing some of these money laundering charges too, is that money was moved illegally to avoid detection. You also get allegations from the government that she really did, after that FTC investigation, tell everyone that they needed to start companies in Wyoming, LLCs wow. in Wyoming that were not in their own name, so they couldn't be traced back to them. They moved over to Telegram, which doesn't show up on your phone bill. It is a more secretive messaging app than having your phone records. So now she's, to me, I took that as, oh, you know they're going to pull your phone records and see who you're talking to, so you're going to an app like a Telegram app, so they won't see who you're talking to in your phone records and things like that. So her behavior definitely changed after that investigation. And that investigation started in 2015 and ran through 2017. And it involved four of the companies that she was involved with, and she was deposed in the course of that. So she's known that this is going on. She's known that this has been raising interest from the government since at least 2015.
So at the beginning of the episode, she takes a call. This is the first episode that we see of the season. From what I've been told today, this was 2 months into filming of the show. So she takes the call, she leaves, then helicopters and a SWAT team arrive. It's in front of Heather's business. Is this typical in this type of case? People are asking, was this necessary for a SWAT team and helicopters in this kind of case?
Oh, they don't know what she's going to do. And they don't know what she's going to do. And they've again, this is the third group of defendants they've dealt with on this fraud scheme. I don't know what their arrests have been like of other defendants. I don't know if those have been with incident, without incident. But they unsealed the two indictments on the same day, rolled out and served search warrants, served the arrest warrants for both her and Stuart Smith. So yes, they do operations like this where they will secure the location and secure the target, particularly in digital investigations where a lot of the evidence can very easily be destroyed very quickly if somebody's tipped off to it. They tend to hit these things pretty hard. And I worked in doing white collar cases at the DA's office on a much, much smaller scale. But in the trainings I participated in, we talked about all the different ways people would get rid of evidence and have kill switches on certain phones. So if you get a phone call, that you can digitally wipe your computers and your iPads and your phones from your phone. So that's a huge concern for law enforcement in an investigation like this. And this investigation has like terabytes of data. This is a very data-driven prosecution. So if she had been able to wipe her phone of information, wipe her home computer, that would have been a huge problem. So yes, they send out big teams to secure the evidence more than that they're worried about securing the person, if that makes sense.
And also there was an inference that someone tipped off the authorities to her whereabouts, even though they're in the middle of showing her life as part of a reality show. Did that make you laugh?
It did make me laugh. And I think it's so funny because people who have never worked with law enforcement, worked with investigations like this, there's so much conspiracy theories and finger pointings. And I'm sure it's going to make fantastic TV by the time we get through the whole season. But I would be very surprised if the government contacted one of the ladies to be like, oh, where will she be? I would not be surprised if they contacted production. But I don't think production knew just from how I watched it go down. I think they showed up at the house and someone at her house told them where she was and then called and let her know so she could get back to the house because they were going to figure out where she was. It would only have taken them a matter of time and they would have triangulated her cell phone when she made that call anyway. So they were already watching her cell phone, I am sure, based on all of the documents that they filed when she tried to have her, you know, statements post-arrest and stuff like that, the dry contacts of it all. When she tried to have all that removed, the government gave us quite a lot of information in their hundreds of pages of responses that they filed. So no, I don't get any sense somebody tipped off the feds to where she was.
Lisa Barlow. Also, if this was happening in 2017, her husband is aware that there is skepticism about her business.
I mean, I don't know how he can't be. She was deposed by the FTC. Her and Stuart Smith both were. So
I
imagine there would be a conversation that's like, if your husband's an attorney, you would say, I have a deposition today and have a conversation about that. Her lawyers have really taken the tack that this is not criminal behavior, that if anything, this is marketing practices that might run afoul of the FTC, but the FTC already investigated. Nothing came of it. So these shouldn't be criminal charges. I disagree with that assessment.
But, wow.
That's kind of the direction that they're going in. And it's funny to see people saying, you know, who tipped them off? I honestly, when I read all of this, initially when this all went down in March and I was looking at the indictment and then I started going back through the other defendants, there were multiple defendants who just recently struck deals with the government before this indictment.
I remember you saying that. Very
much more likely that in those plea deals, that when those defendants proffered evidence to the government, which I'm not saying did happen, I'm saying is likely to have happened, that they would have said, oh, and by the way, these are the other two that are attached, and this is how they're attached to it, because that's how you get a better deal for yourself. If you're the last defendant in, someone has spoken your name to the police.
No kidding. Again, Emily, why would someone want to be on a TV show after they've already gone through depositions? I mean, what are we dealing with here? A madman? Like, what is wrong with her?
I think we're seeing the same level of kind of arrogance and and perhaps narcissism that we see from a Tom Girardi or an Elizabeth Holmes. I've said it when we've talked before. I think the personality types are very similar. They believe their own hype. I really do think Jen Shah believes in her mind that everything she was doing, we are just all too dumb to understand it.
Right.
Like, she is the brilliant one. We are all ridiculous and we are all stupid and we do not understand why this is just business and not actually fraud. I disagree again, but fraud defendants are like this. They tend to testify on their own behalf because they think they're the smartest person
That's
in the room.
True.
Always. They are quick to anger. They are frustrated when they are questioned, and it makes them very volatile on the stand. I've been screamed at in court by fraud defendants. I was cross-examining, and then I just sat down and stopped talking. I was like, well, they're not going to, this isn't going to get any better for this jury. They've seen who this person really is now.
Correct.
In this moment. Now it is time for me to sit down and be very, very quiet and not mess up the cross-examination I just did. But I think we're going to see that from Jen Shah. We're seeing that in the way she's like, do I need to get Kim Kardashian on my legal team? She's making a joke out of it, probably because not a lot happened from the prior FTC investigations. And it's not connecting with her that that is a very different story than the Southern District of New York prosecutors.
Do you think it has come to any point yet where she's starting to get it? Or do you think she's still under the delusion that this is just going to be swept under the rug and go away?
I don't know. I mean, she got rid of one of her legal teams. I thought that that might indicate that she was leaning towards a plea. I don't know if that's within her personality to take a deal that's better for herself. It looks like Stuart Smith is anticipating taking a plea. I don't know how much this would have sunk in. And I don't know if she will try to save herself, even if she doesn't believe what the government's charging her with, or if she'll just go down swinging. I'm kind of leaning towards go down swinging. What do you think?
I think so. I think that she is looking at this season, even again, this all happened 2 months into filming. Her behavior is that of someone who believes that they're a sitcom actress. She yes. thinks she's a TV personality. She thinks this is all funny, and she doesn't seem to have a grasp of reality in any capacity. So I feel badly Agreed. For her children, who seem to be adorable. And I mean, they're older now, but the way that they are, their lives will be destroyed by their mother. I mean, it's just unconscionable. I can't yep. quite figure out yet what's going on with the husband. So I wondered what you think about that. And then I wanted you to tell me what you think about her friendship with Lisa Barlow.
I don't know what's going on with Coach Shaw. And I don't know how much willful blindness there is. I don't know how much of the, I don't know how long he's been traveling and coaching. And so how much of what she's doing he doesn't see. I also think it would be hypocritical of me to leave those questions open with regards to Erica Girardi and not leave mm-hmm. them open with regards to Coach Shaw, because I don't know how involved he was. I believe that if he was involved enough, the U.S. Attorney's Office would have charged him as well. He's clearly not involved enough for them to charge him. So I don't know if he was just like, okay, hon, whatever you say, business, business, business. The FTC didn't really do much. I mean, the FTC did shut down the businesses that she was running. She just started new ones, but the FTC didn't really do, well, there was $1 million fine. I mean, maybe that is a lot.
But if we saw Coach Shaw in an Instagram photo and he was laying across a Ferrari and he had some, you know, like, what's up, you know, suckers or something, we would freak out the way that we're freaking out about Erica.
Yes.
He yes. seems to be quiet and yes. he's presented himself all along as this very kind and generous, thoughtful, even-tempered football coach. So I think that's why the audience is a little bit more sympathetic to him.
I think so too. I mean, and Erica's the one on TV. She's the center, kind of the center of her own hurricane right now, even though the behavior was Tom's. But she's the one that's doing wild stuff on Instagram that's making people question what she's thinking. And Jen's doing the same thing. Jen Shaw is the actual one who's doing the action. It's interesting to me watching the different yes. treatment of Erica Girardi versus Jen Shaw, because Jen Shaw is alleged to have done the things. Erica's alleged right. to have benefited from the things. She's not a subject of the bankruptcy. She's mm-hmm. being sued in the bankruptcy. She's not the subject to a criminal indictment at this point. So Erica has spent the money from the victims. Jen Shaw took... Well, is alleged to have taken the money from the victims yeah. and then spent the money and then laundered the money. And you had asked me earlier about the closet full of clothes, and I didn't bring it up, but there is a asset forfeiture on this case. And a civil asset forfeiture when the U.S. government comes a knocking is if they can't find where the money went, they can substitute different assets for that money to recoup
oh, wow.
it. So if they're saying, oh, well, the money must have gone into clothes and bags and here and there and come out in cash and you went and bought stuff with it, they can go after those types of property. So it'll be very interesting to see what they try to get after. I also wonder if it's why she doesn't hold property in her name and is spending
oh,
exorbitant amounts of money on these leases, because there's nothing... that money's just gone and you can write it off. So there's nothing really coming from it. So it'll be interesting to see how the finances shake out at the end of this too. And of course, what the IRS has to say. Because once you've been indicted on money laundering and wire fraud, the IRS is going to have a few questions about what you've been up to tax-wise.
What about this friendship with Lisa Barlow? What do you make of it?
It's
why
odd.
Why is she so sympathetic to Jen?
I don't know. I was very annoyed watching Lisa say it's the exact same thing as what's going on with, you know, Jen coming after, you know, Brooks Marks. See, Marks. I just got off a plane today. So my apologies for the fuzzy brain. But like, she came after him so hard on social media. It's not the same thing to me at all.
No, it's
as some women calling Lisa kind of cold and judgy and Jen going after kids.
A child's, you know, sexuality.
When they're adult kids. It's just, it's horrific. And it's not the same. So it's confusing to me why Lisa has chosen that hill. And I don't know why it is. I don't know if Lisa likes the chisme, like likes the drama and the gossip of it all, and wants to be on the inside with Jen because that's how you get the gossip and the swirling of it. I don't know. It doesn't feel authentic. It feels calculated to me. So we'll see how that plays out.
I wondered if at some point she figured at the beginning of the season that the audience was going to enjoy Jen more. It was like a strategic alliance that went bad.
It does. It does. It feels calculated. I think alliance is a good way to put it. She's like the Dwight Schrute. Would you like to form an alliance with me? And I think it's because she wasn't, I don't know how she, and I don't watch a lot of what goes on off of airing of the show. I don't follow what all the ladies are doing on social media. But I wonder if she also saw how everyone perceived her after the last season aired and wanted to make a little bit of a change too, right? So this kind of shakes it up a little bit. Yeah.
So Meredith's family is back. She and her husband, I'm rooting for them. They're back together. And she and her son, I felt like we're very troubled by what happened on social media once the season began to air. And I could feel the impact, you know, as you could watch it. I wondered if you felt the same way. And I suspect that that relationship, that friendship with Lisa is so fractured now because she didn't support Brooks. What do you think?
I think so. And I think it's such a surreal place to be in, I would imagine, at least with what I do on YouTube. It's kind of instantaneous. You put things out, same with podcasting, you put things out pretty close to when you do it or say it or record it. And then you keep going and moving on. With Housewives, they record so far in advance, especially with that first season, that by the time everybody's watching it, it's really old news for the ladies, but now you're rehashing everything and watching it in real time. And then people coming after her son, who I think was my favorite housewife from the first season. He was great. He was deadpan voice of reasoning. And he thought Jed Shaw was acting classless in his home in front of him and his sister, and he wasn't having it. I thought her flipping out about that was unwarranted. I mean, more has happened. More has been called out on other franchises. It seemed ridiculous. But yeah, I think watching it all go down and not getting backed up definitely fractured that relationship. And these women, you know, different than franchises that have been around longer, this is more like the early seasons of New Jersey where everyone really is connected to one another, it seems. They really did have these long-standing friendships. That would be very, very hurtful to me if a friend of years didn't have my back if somebody was coming after my kid, because I don't know how I would take that. I don't imagine I would respond well, at least not behind the scenes. I would not be happy. And it's something you consider when you put your life, or at least do work on the internet or in the public space somewhat, is trying to keep your kids protected in all of it.
I have been open about how I thought last season did not feel connected. I didn't feel like any of them most of them did not have real friendships. But I do feel like the experience of the Housewives show after the first season, I always say that the show is kind of in three phases. So I have a friend who's going to be on Real Housewives of Orange County. And she said, filming's been so fun. And I went, well, just wait a minute. Because it's like phase one is the filming. Phase two is watching yourself and your story play back and hearing your castmates rip you apart. And then the third phase is the audience response. And it just seems like Meredith and Brooks and family have taken that really hard. Phases two and three. So I do think that those women are bonded by the experience of seeing your life play back and having the criticism. And so in a weird way, I felt like it was more interesting to watch this season because they feel more connected. And they also feel a little bit more willing to crack more of their lives open. Although Whitney is this season talking about her new business and pulling away from her husband, Justin, and having some, you know, autonomy. But what I did not like was when she took a water bottle and basically said, I don't have to perform oral sex on him anymore for money. I was appalled by that scene, and I wondered if you felt the same.
I watched it back twice because I was like, this didn't just happen. Like, she didn't just say that basically she was being paid for sexual favors to her husband, but she did. I think she thinks she's funny. And I think she's leaning into this, like, I'm young, he's old, I'm the same age as my stepkids, and I'm hot, and I'm going to get drunk, and it's amazing. The whole first episode with Whitney Rose for me was messy. And she's like, I'm going to show them how to work hard and play hard. I'm like, you dropped a cake three times. Maybe we stop playing this hard.
Right.
But that, like, because that's what you're choosing to show. You know what filming is now. This is not a first season. It was just really uncomfortably messy. And even the previews of the season with her, like, covered with chocolate sauce in a bra and underwear with her husband, like, smacking her on the ass. I was like, great for you. Go have a good sex life. I really don't need to know that much about it on Housewives. So it's an odd dynamic for me. She's coming out hard with, like, this is my business and this is, you know, my platform. I wonder if they saw it benefit Heather having storylines around her business last year. I'm wondering if that's where this is coming.
I don't want to hear any woman put herself down like that. I just thought, I hope that she saw that back and felt some concern. I don't know.
I think she thinks it's funny. I really do. Yeah. I got the sense like, oh, I'm so free and I'm so open and I'm so, you know, ha ha ha.
Okay, so new housewife Jenny. I love a new housewife because it brings a new, fresh element to the show. She was a businesswoman. She just sold her businesses and she's going to be at home with the kids now. Adorable husband, funny kids, which is always great. She seems to be hilarious and a really interesting personal story as a refugee. Are you excited about Jenny like I am?
I'm absolutely excited. I hope they dive more into her story. And
me too.
I love how they shared the beginning of her story. Cause I'm like, this is not just like leaving your home country. She left and was captured in a refugee camp and sponsored to come here. And it was interesting seeing how all of that played into it. And I do hope to see more of it. I thought her husband seemed really sweet. I thought it was interesting how she was kind of dogging his looks. She's like, his body was great, but from the neck up, I'm like, what are you throwing your husband under the bus on television for? But we'll see. She does seem really sweet. And again, it's this, you know, maybe the women weren't super close friends, but this community connectedness. And before we moved, we had a small community where you kind of know everyone and you are connected to the people in your small community. And that's what Salt Lake City kind of gave to me. These are women that ran in the same circle. It wasn't like trying to tangentially just grab somebody and bring them into the show. And I felt that with Jenny too. I love the story about them bumping bellies and having kids the same age. But it was also funny how Lisa's like, we're not about money, but you and I have the best purses there. I'm like, seriously, in the same breath.
Exactly. But also nice to see somebody who's self-made because the shows often are about aspirational living. And now we're at a point where we don't even know if someone's wealth is really, it's smoke and mirrors or not. I thought that was really great that they did that. Brought in somebody who has a really interesting personal story. I did feel like I was going to be concerned that the show would be all about Jen Shah in the way that Beverly Hills is really kind of all about Erica. And I think that they've done a really good job of telling their own personal stories. And that leads me to my question about Mary. Robert Sr. is nowhere to be seen. And she's given up, apparently, the church, and now she's doing podcasts. What do you think's really going on behind the scenes?
I really don't know. I really don't know. I've seen the speculation online. I understand, because when they were filming this, I got the sense that they were still having some COVID concerns, but things were starting, even in California, by March, things were starting to open up and churches were starting to open up. I wonder if when they were filming, Utah had started open up. I didn't even know she had a podcast. All of it's very confusing to me. The snippets that we're seeing for stuff coming up is going to be interesting. There's something sad for me about Mary kind of wandering around this house with so much stuff everywhere. It's just, there's just something deeper there. And the story with Robert Sr. being gone didn't make any sense to me.
No, but that's what keeps you coming back every episode, is feeling like you're going to peel another layer back.
Yeah.
Like a puzzle piece. Like at the end of this, we're going to have some understanding of who she is. And so I'm really excited about that. I was not thinking I would be as excited about Real Housewives of Salt Lake City as I am.
What did it for me is when Jen was sitting on the couch with Lisa and was like, you know, I'd go to jail for you. I haven't been to jail yet. And I was like, this is what we're throwing out there. First episode of what she said 2 months ago, Jen Shah. The hubris, like just the hubris of Jen Shah. It is just unbelievable. I haven't been to jail yet. She knew. She knew that the others had been indicted. She knew that they were pending trial. And that's what she says. She cannot help herself.
She cannot help herself. And then to see all of their faces once the helicopters, you know, have arrived. And you can see the fear, the curiosity, the pain in their faces. Really just compelling storytelling. Tell everybody where they can find you, because you are covering so many legal cases all the time. You're my go-to law nerd. Tell everybody where they can follow you.
Absolutely. Thank you. I am at the Emily D. Baker all over the internet. So Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. I break down cases on YouTube 3 times a week. And I have a podcast that has a more concise version of my content at the Emily Show.
And where can people find you on Instagram and Twitter?
At the Emily D. Baker.
Thank you so much, Emily.
Thank you, Kate. It's so good to see you.
The amazing Kate Casey.
I want to thank my great guests, Marty and Emily, and remind you guys to click subscribe, leave a 5-star review, jump in the Facebook group Reality Life with Kate Casey, join the Patreon page for bonus episodes. Go to patreon.com/Kate Casey. You can find me on Twitter at Kate Casey. I tweet about shows and during shows all week long. At Kate Casey CA on Instagram. Please follow me. My TikTok is It's Kate Casey. And you can get my must watch list that comes out every Monday in your inbox by going to katecasey.substack.com. My must watch list of what to watch all week long. I'm hoping you have a great week, and I can't wait to circle back with you on Friday. I've got Wells Adams from Bachelor in Paradise.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.